Douglas, we were talking about practice and discipline. Do you think a discipline of some sort is necessary or helpful to see?
Sort of meditation and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
In a sense, it's absolutely indispensable, Richard, surely. It's rather paradoxical. There's nothing to be done because one is okay, the situation is absolutely all right. But one is who one is. Nothing can stop that, nothing can prevent that, interfere with that. And what one is as a human being, well, that is what it has to be, that's got its place, and looked at from its origin, it's perfectly in order. So what then is to be done? Where does the discipline come in? And a lot of Zen masters would rub that in, you know, what are you trying to do? Your trouble is that you think there's some trouble. And if you would see that everything as it is all right, and relax into that, all would be achieved. In fact, the thing to be achieved is the idea that there's nothing to be achieved. That is the real achievement. And having said that, it's also true to say that having seen one, who one is, which is a bit of cake, and totally available, easy. The easiest thing in the world is to see into one's true nature. Simply by turning the arrow of one's attention round, it's the easiest thing in the world. However, as you well know, it's also the most difficult thing in the world, almost. That's not quite true, but it's certainly a very difficult thing to maintain this inward look at all. At first, with most people, it's something that is not only hard to keep up, but impossible to keep up. It's very, very intermittent. One's always being diverted from it. So at best, it is enormously interrupted. At worst, it's something you do just a few times in your life, perhaps. Well, in one sense, and what's wrong with that? Because since looking into who one is looking into the timeless realm, and there are indeed no gaps between the lookings in, no gaps at all of time, then what's the trouble? Does one need to maintain in time that which is out of time? Of course not. But if we're looking at the thing from the point of view of the world of time, and that's where we function in the world of time, don't we? We function from the timeless into the timed world. World of time, if we're looking to that functioning in time, why? That's where the practice is absolutely essential. Otherwise, nothing really happens.
What kind of practice?
It's ineffective. The seeing of who we are is fruitless, it's a barren thing. Nothing comes of it. It has no consequences for living. So in order that this timeless, the seeing into the timeless shall bear fruit in time, a very great deal of work has to be done. I use work in inverted commas. Now what is the work? The work is not an achievement. The work is the constantly coming back to see that there is nothing to be achieved and all is well. So the work is not doing something afresh. It is the observation that there is really no work to do and all is well. And What is it? Then what is this work? This work is the turning round of the arrow of one's attention, as often as may be. And that is the practice.
That leads me on to another issue, is the maintaining of this. How one maintains this, gets it going, keeps it going.
Well, that's in a way what we're talking about, yeah. Isn't it? This practice is the maintenance of this in-looking. And how does one do this? One practices this by doing it, by turning the arrow of one's attention around, as I say, in all the circumstances of life, increasingly, so that, in a way, one doesn't need to do it any longer. Because in a way, it's going on all the time. And one is in touch all the time, sometimes very consciously and vividly, aware of where one's coming from, aware of the nothingness here, the one's true nature. Sometimes very vividly, and sometimes more often, perhaps, in a subdued way. But one is aware of it. One is not out to lunch. One isn't out there in negligence of what is here. There is a kind of... I think you recognize it. You know what I'm talking about. This sense of, here am I gone. It's a funny way to put it. But a sense of I'm here and I'm not here, here am I, absent, or present as awareness of my self as having no characteristics, capacity for the world. The practice is ceasing to overlook the looker or the hearer, the one who is here.
Is there a sense in which you ever have to make an effort to pay attention to that? At this point,
it really, I suppose there is, in a way. I think effort is not the right word, really, but I can't give a better one. I think we have to go on making an effort until we see that effort is quite pointless, really, in a way. It's not an effortful thing at all, is it? It's more like a relaxation. It's a relaxation back into what is forever established. And an effort is to produce something that's not established. And relaxation is sinking back into what is already present. And this is present. How can we be effortful about something that's already doing really well? Thank you very much.
Are there certain things or situations that for you are promotive of seeing, help you to see, remind you of seeing?
Oh, very much so. Although there are situations where the seeing into one's true nature, this reverse look, this in-seeing, is very vivid, and there are other occasions when it is present all right, but not in a very sharp way, which is perfectly okay. It doesn't have to be brilliantly on show. Ramana, as you know, pointed out that it's not in its nature to be always sharp and brilliant and very, very prominent. It's more in its nature to be like a background for one's life.
What kind?
Well, the occasions which your question, occasions which for me are apt to produce the sharp sense, seeing of the space here. For instance, the situation we're in now. I mean, there's Richard and Richard's face there, and here's the absence of mine here. And I think one had built up over the years a very strong habit of being face to no face, I think one needed to do that in order to get out of the nonsense habit previously of being face to face, which is never true, or was it I? Troublesome and productive of all sorts of tensions and fear and all sorts of trouble. So that is a situation, having a person in front of me, anyone, a face there, whether I know it or not, that is extremely helpful. I find, I guess you do too.
Yeah, I agree. Yes.
What other occasions do we feel especially helpful? I think when you see something strikingly beautiful, like flowers and colours, or just anything that strikes you as lovely. Like music, beautiful patterns. I think the things in the world which are attractive and seem to be very attractive, I think don't attract one in the sense of pull one out, to lose oneself in the object. Rightly perceived, I think they reveal the subject as much as the object, and they're absolutely one. Mm. I think previously, you say, oh, it's very attractive, isn't she attractive, isn't the scene attractive, aren't those flowers attractive? Attraction means pulling you out, doesn't it? Pulling you out there, right. Which is the exact opposite. Now, I hope, with some this training we're talking about, that these attractive things are also concentrating things.
What about the place of workshops? I know they're for sharing scene, but both for sharing and reminding. Some people don't like them, do they?
Of course they are so effective. And I mean, in a workshop, you and I have done so many together. And I expect it's your experience as it is mine, that you can spend an hour, 2 hours, and really virtually your seeing has been very sharp all the time. I mean, I don't know if anyone else is getting a lot out of this workshop, one feels, but certainly it's a way of concentrating one's attention to this, because you cannot, I mean, if it were possible, it would be quite wrong and fraudulent, wouldn't it? But it's not possible, I think, to run the kind of workshop we're talking about without all the while being sharply aware of the absence of someone who's running that workshop. So I would say it's a superb opportunity, superb practice.
The experiments,
this attention.
Yes, the experiments themselves, would you do them or recommend them as ways of reminding oneself?
You mean out of workshop?
Yeah.
Well, I think we're all different, and I must admit, I don't go around pointing fingers and into here, and I don't go around putting cars with holes on my face. You know, I don't do that. And I suppose my explanation of this negligence, of this negligence, is that I don't, you know, life is a workshop, and I don't really need to produce special contrivances. Life is better at that than I am. Life produces situations which are just what's needed, and I don't really need to interfere too much with that. But I think we're all different, and I suppose those of us for whom this is it's not been going a long time, for those of us for whom this is fairly new and fresh, habits have to be formed here. Well, I think it may well be that frequently using this in-pointing finger, or very consciously observing the single eye, why that would be very appropriate. We're all different. We have to each do what we can do. I think there's no standard pattern. But I do think there are things which are common to us all. And this face-to-face thing, or rather face-to-no-face thing, is something which is so sharp and good and important, isn't it? And of course, if... Oh, there's another one. Another one. And practice which are really helpful, and that is being face to no face with friends who share this because of the infection. You know, this came around all the group, the reinforcement is tremendous, I think.
It's a paradox, isn't it? Because one is alone and yet one is sharing.
Yes, yeah. So I think that that's skillful. It's skillful to hang around people that are doing this.
What about difficult situations and problems? Do those help or hinder?
Well, what are you thinking of? What kind of problem?
I wasn't thinking of anything in specific. Maybe personal relationship problems, work problems, health problems.
All the troubles of life.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be much good if it didn't have a relevance to these things. I think it has immense relevance to them. Well, I think, first of all, it doesn't dispose of them. It doesn't get rid of them. I think that it may almost seem you've got a special crop of them. It may be that, maybe because one is more aware of what's going on and more sensitive, and perhaps taking on responsibilities and caring for, you know, people and so on, and one would seem to have a more complex and, you know, very troublesome life after seeing, would have all seen quite often. One might feel that. But no, it's not a case of getting rid of problems. In fact, as I say, it can sometimes almost seem the other way around. But nevertheless, something very profound, don't you think, is going on. And it is that the problem is being looked at just the way your face is being looked at this moment. It's been looked at from no face, and the problem has been looked at from no problem. And that one has a sense, even perhaps rather cloudy, not very sharp and clear, or maybe sharp and clear, one has a sense of being space for the problem rather than the problem. And one is the problem, just as I am your face. I mean, the space that your face is revealed to be in is not other than your face. But nevertheless, the space is terribly important. Well, space for the problem, although in a sense it's united, the space is what makes a difference. I mean, normally, I would say, till we cotton onto this thing, it's just a problem, isn't it? It's wrong. But this is the problem seen from the no problem, distinguished utterly. The problem is distinguished utterly from its source. And then they come together, and the problem, I suppose in very simple, practical terms, one realizes that that problem is absolutely okay to be problematic at this time. It's accepted. Because when a thing is seen from the source, it is authorized. It's not just seen from the source, it's okayed, in a sense. It can be very painful, I mean, like being very ill or dying, for that matter. Whatever it might be. When it is perceived consciously from the place where it is perceived from, consciously, it's transformed not by a kind of detailed revision or manipulation. It's transformed by viewing it from what is a freedom point, from one who one is.
Does this mean that you're not involved in trying to sort out your problems or improve your situation or whatever?
Yes, I think it does mean that one's not involved in that. I think one, in a way, one sees this problem as part of the world, and I have no power at all to interfere with. One doesn't have nothing to do, really, except to look at it as it is given. And, I mean, to change this, get rid of this problem, change it all together, remove it, or even change it at all, would be to change the whole world. And because everything hangs together in a web of mutual conditioning. And this problem of mine, if I took it in its fullness, it would embrace the universe, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, because everything is conditioned by everything else. We've got this idea that we can treat the world by action, piecemeal, rooting out this problem and that problem, or at any rate, transforming it. I think this is illusory. I think it's illusory. What I can do is to be the source of the problem and the source of the whole world, really. And this is to not want to change it, really, but to accept it and see that it's okay. It's a hard thing, isn't it? I mean, you know, something pretty nasty happens in one's life. I want to say very ill. A very dear friend is having an awful time, or the one circumstances have taken them really nosedive. Well, what can one do? It's a certain level, of course. I mean, it depends what level we're talking about. A certain level in which one must do something. I mean, no, you couldn't take action. But in the last resort, that action is just as conditioned as the thing that's being treated. That will occur anyway, that action, won't it? I mean, these hands get up to something, these feet will go somewhere, this voice will continue to sound. All that stuff is all conditioned stuff. My business is not really to fuss about that. My business is to be where it's all coming from.
Being where it's all coming from is not a purely passive place or state, is it?
No, I don't think it is. No. No.
Because you're a very active person, you know, from this nothingness, it's a creative place. I'm just thinking that it could sound like it just means sitting back doing nothing.
Yeah, fatalism.
Yeah.
Saying I'm okay here, and I have no control over what happens out there, and I'm just going to sit at home, idle and uncaring, really, or resigned to what's going on. It's not like that at all. In a sense, it's extremely active. I mean, after all, who am I? Who are you? Who is one? One is the action itself. I mean, one is this power, which is that's one's true nature. I mean, this void here, this emptiness here, is the father and mother of everything. From this, the world is generated. Well, that is, in a way, actually the only energy there is. So one is energetic in a sense. But I think my task is not to, is to let let all that energy, that power, that creativity, let it flow, as it were, in a way, and recognize it, enjoy it. But I feel my pleasure, my job is to not kind of monitor that, not kind of try and guide it, change it, get involved in it in a way, but to stay with where it's coming from. In really stay with the abyss, the unknowable, the potentiality, not the actuality so much as the potentiality. Then the actuality, one is that too. But the emphasis of identification for me, I think, is on the source. Stay with the source. Stay with the center and the periphery will be okay. Go for the periphery and in negligence of the center, the circumference or periphery, and one is literally in trouble. Only make for the center. Right where one is, stay there and hold as well. And of course the center, it is the center, it's right here, center point. And I look at the center point and of course it expands infinitely in all directions. The center explodes, but it's just the center one makes for.
What do you think the individual psychological and social effects of this scene are?
Gosh, they would differ so much person to person, wouldn't they? I mean, we all start off, we all have our special handicaps and crosses and limitations and what is the effect going to be of living this scene life on those handicaps and so forth? What's it going to be? I think it's quite unpredictable, don't you? I mean, there are even moods in which one feels that Richard or Douglas perhaps is as much stuck in the mire there and as crummy a character as ever. No, I'm not. This business of fruits is a hard one, isn't it? It's a very hard one. But nevertheless, there are fruits. One must admit that there are fruits. And if we go for them, we're in trouble. If we're too concerned with them, we're in trouble. I mean, it's a. It's a cliché to say it, but it really is true. You know, if you want good fruit, you don't fuss about fruit. You feed the roots, don't you, the tree. You feed the roots of the tree, make sure they're healthy and well. And the fruits will come. You don't water because the ground's parched. You don't water the fruit, you water the ground. And it seems to me, look after the ground and the fruit will come. And I think the point about it is that the fruits are in time and the roots are out of time. And the roots are timeless, eternal, no thickness, dark, hidden, the abyss, that's the root. And the fruits are in time and always changing and ripening and so forth. And unpredictable. You don't know. Time will tell. But all the same, having said that, Richard, everything, by seeing who one is, you know, it seems to me that fundamentally the hang-ups of our life are taken care of. I mean, you could list what come, the agony, the nonsense, the handicaps, the troubles that arise from living a lie, from the illusion that one is a thing, a small, limited, temporary, opaque thing here. I get shrunk from being space for everything, which I am as an infant, or even I am being no thing, space for everything. I get shrunk into being this little thing here. Now, what is the fruit of that shrinkage? The fruit of that shrinkage is all sorts of trouble. I mean, I'm angry because of I resent the society which cruelly cut me down to size. I'm frightened because things are frightened. I mean, if I'm a thing, I'm terribly vulnerable from the activity of other things, the hostility, abrasion, other things, aren't I? I'm terrified, really. I'm envious. I'm envious of possessions and achievements of others. The world was mine. Now I've shrunk to a little bit of the world. I could be greedy to get more and more of the world, to establish again my ownership of the world if I can. Of course, it's a hopeless task. All I do is get more burdens in the way of possessions. And so this illusion that I am what I look like, which we began with right at the beginning of this talk we've been having, this illusion that I am a thing in the world here, I am what I look like, this illusion is productive of all our troubles, really. And it's living from a lie that gets me into this terrible trouble. Now, many things, greed, hate, delusion, with all their offspring, fear and so forth, all of those things can be the origin, can be traced, why, to this illusion, this lie that I've been living from, that I'm a thing here. Now, when I start living from the no thing here, and I don't really start living from that, I mean, it stands to reason. It's obvious that there's going to be a, insofar as I succeed in living from the truth instead of the lie, the effects of it must be there, for the reasons I've stated. No longer am I greedy, or very greedy, because if the world is mine, what's the point of getting little bits and pieces around me to prove the world is mine? I do nothing by that. I just add to my troubles by collecting a lot of junk around me. I don't need to be greedy. If I see that here is the origin of the world, and this is indestructible, eternal, then where's the place for fear? And where's the place for envy? And so forth. It seems to me that the fruits. The fruits are there. They may be invisible to oneself. They're probably more visible to other people than oneself. The fruits are there. I think St. Paul is right. By their fruits, did he say this? By their fruits shall you know them. And if they're no fruits, well, you know, it's because the root is not being tended to. And fruits are there, and you can't avoid. There's a sense in which you can't avoid judging the tree by its fruits. And the fruits, I would say, are unique in every case, unpredictable. And they're not really one's business to fuss about the fruits. I don't really think one has fruits. It's who one is. One doesn't have fruits. The only fruit I have as who I really am is this darn great fruit of the whole universe. That's a fruit and a half, isn't it? That one is. I mean, that's the fruit. To talk about little fruits here and there is to is to confuse what I am. I mean, what am I? Am I little Douglas bearing a lot of silly old fruits? No. I am the origin of the whole lot, and that's my fruit. That'll do me. I'm a fruit merchant. My father was a fruit merchant. So am I.
Yeah. Do you think this, I mean, you spend your life writing about this, talking about this, sharing this, living this. Do you think it's going to be more and more available and accepted? Because still it feels society doesn't welcome this, doesn't acknowledge this. Is it going to become more popular?
Crystal ball now. What do you think? I'm going to wriggle out of that one.
No, I don't know.
Well, I don't see much change, really, you know. I don't see much change. I mean, I frequently have friends say, things are looking up, you know. Now we're getting, you know, letters from Iceland and Greece, and lovely things happened in the Rockies or somewhere. Gosh, and what a beautiful letter that was. And the no-hit thing seems to be getting round, selling rather well, which is rather nice. And one feels encouraged. That things are changing. Well, I don't know. I don't know. I know that nothing's gone wrong. I know that all is well. And that there is a sense in which nothing. It's a nonsense, really, to count no heads. You know, counting heads is makes sense. Counting no heads makes no sense. There's only one no head. Plotinus, marvellous. He said, out there the many faces, but here the one head all. If we could but turn round by our own motion, or by the happy pull of Athene, we would look in and find here the self and God and the all. Well, and I ain't gone wrong with that, you know.
Well,
and out there the many faces, here the one head of all. And the one head of all is okay now. It's got to be many faces out there. And it's got to be the one no head here, because who you are there is absolutely unique. You'll never find anything as you go around the universe. You'll never find anything remotely resembling what you're looking out of now. It's the one head of all that is there, head with a capital H, not a thing full of brains and stuff. I mean head in the sense of all, rather like the St. Paul talking about Christ as the head, the body. The one at all, says Plotinus. And so this business of numbers. Faces are many. This one head is already unitary, perfect, established. Yeah, I think we look at the time world, we always get picture like this. We always will. We look in, nothing gone wrong. Everything is all right now. It's heaven now. It's not nothing to be done, really. It's okay now. It's not something gone wrong with the world and the world's going to get better. It's that we're not seeing the world right when we're not seeing the world really, really, really as it is when we are worried about the state of affairs now. Or a bit concerned, thinking, my God, you know, about time people tumble to the simple thing that we're onto, and, you know, why aren't we winning more assent from the world? This is a level at which this is perfectly understandable and natural. But a more fundamental level, it's absolute nonsense. And that all that's gone wrong is that we haven't seen the world, is it? We haven't seen reality as it is. out there the many faces. Absolutely. Here, the one.
Do you feel this inward look to be a very important leap in one's consciousness? Because we've been so identified, with our outward appearance.
Mm. Well, of course, there's that way of looking at it, isn't there? The evolutionary way of looking at it, which is very interesting. I mean, if we're talking about the world of time, you know, really ignoring the timeless source and all that, and talking in historical terms, in terms of this kind of newsreel about the story of humanity, and we began, what, 5 million years ago? I don't know how long ago, something like that. There's a very, very skillful, intelligent, fairly upright animals, anthropoids, who didn't see themselves as objects, didn't live in the world as objects in the world for themselves. They were capacitive for the world. Just like the space for babies now and other animals are. And then the great leap forward and taking, no doubt, many hundreds of thousands of years to accomplish a slow leap in the space. And yet, in certain sense, a sudden leap was this business of looking at yourself from out there and seeing yourself as an object, along with other objects. Objectifying oneself, probably with the help of a mirror. Well, not the mirror, but a mirror surface, the surface of water. Whenever you see your image there, and you play, one can imagine a primeval man, or a little poor child, a gifted child, adventurous child, pulling faces where he was and seeing what happens in the water. See that little boy pulling faces in the water. And he finds that there's a correspondence between the sensations here, the timing of them, and even the nature of them, and the picture in the water. There's a correspondence. And then from there he would go on to eventually, I suppose, catch a hold of that face, as it were, and say, well, it looks over there, but it's really here. And here am I, just like the others. I am what I look like. And then he was a human being. And that process, I would get that all sorted out a long, long time. And it isn't complete yet for some people. I mean, some people are not really arrived at that full objectivity. I mean, there are some very simple people and primitive types that hadn't quite made it yet, really. That was an evolutionary leap of, well, all important is what made us human, and the product of this, that leap, is everything we call civilization, and the human condition is the result of that. The human condition, with all its positive things, as well as its terribly negative ones. Well, now, it seems to me the adventure of the future, which may come off on this planet or may not, and I feel sure it'll come off on some planet, or is coming off on maybe hundreds of millions of planets now, I don't know. The next step is to take the gains of all that adventure into self-objectification and combine it with the neglected original truth, which the animal, the tiny baby are living. But making it now conscious, connecting the two, so that one takes the gains of self-objectification and reverts also to true subjectivity. So one is object, subject, and with the emphasis on subject, and that is that I am here, just I am, and there I am Douglas. And it's the union of those two which is the next step in evolution, maybe. In other words, we see who we are. What we do is to remain members of the human club, but to secretly withdraw our subscription. Our subscription being this illusion that I am what I look like. And quite obviously, our friends who see this very clearly are more human in a sense than before. I think the way to be a really genuine human being is to see that you're not a human being here. You're only a human being there.